There is a story in Srimad Bhagavatam about a great king. His name was Yadu, and he was a forefather of Krishna, who was born in the Yadu dynasty. One time he was traveling through a forest with just a few of his assistants. And he happened to come upon a most extraordinary personality. This person he wasn't really wearing any clothes. He had no home. He just lived in the forest. And he looked so peaceful. And this was contradictory to the king's way of thinking. Because in the world, people naturally feel that if I have a home, if I have people I love, if I have nice clothes, if I have facilities, I'll be happy. If I have good food. But this person had none of that. And not only that, but he looked very heavy. Not fat, but he didn't look like he was hungry at all. So the king asked him, "How is it that you looked so enlightened and so peaceful while you're living alone in the middle of the jungle?" He replied, "It's because I have learned such great wisdom from my gurus." King Yadu asked, "Who are your gurus?" He said, "I have 24 gurus. Would you like to hear about them?" Well, it's several chapters in Srimad Bhagavatam. So I'd like to just share with you tonight what he learned from a few of his gurus. His first guru, he said, was the moon. He said, "I learned about the true identity of the self from the moon. Because the moon is waxing and waning constantly. Can't escape that stuff." Coming all the way up. Sometimes it's a quarter moon, sometimes it's a half moon, sometimes it's a three-quarter moon, sometimes Amavasya, a no moon. That's the biggest day of bathing in the Kumbh Mela, is the Amavasya. February 10th, if any of you want to come. It's the moonless night. So the moon is waxing and waning with every day. But he said, "But in reality, the moon is always a full moon. There's never a quarter moon. It's just our perception of the moon according to how the light of the sun is reflecting upon it. So there's always a full moon, but our perception is sometimes quarter, sometimes half, sometimes three quarters, sometimes nothing." And in the same way, the Atma, the living force within every living being, is Satchidananda. It's eternal, it's full of knowledge, it's full of bliss. And it's nahanyate hanyamane sarire. It's neither subjected to birth nor death. The Gita tells, dehino smin yata dehe komaram yovaram jara. That the appearance, the living being, the living force within us is moving through these different apparent phases of infancy, babyhood, childhood, adolescence, you remember those days. And then we become middle-aged, and then old age, and then really old age. And then if we live that long, the body falls away. It's like the waxing and waning of the moon. It has absolutely no effect on the eternal soul. It's just the appearance through this material vision. I remember, now I'm adding something to what the Srimad Bhagavatam tells, but it's in harmony with the message. I remember I took a group of young teenage boys and girls, two busfuls, to the Kings Canyon in California. Have any of you been to Kings Canyon? It has the largest trees on Mother Earth. We went to the biggest tree on Earth. His name is General Sherman. He's a sequoia tree. And he's so big, I'm trying to remember the exact statistics, but if you hollowed out the trunk and filled it with water, it could give a family of six people three baths a day for something like 36 years. And if a mouse looked up at a six-foot man, it would be the exact same experience as us looking up at the tree, the general tree. And according to scientists, that tree has been standing there for 2,100 years. So I asked this group of young people, if General Sherman could give humanity a message, what would he say? He was here before Jesus Christ. He was here during the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. He was standing right there in the same soul and the same body. Through the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, he was here before any long millennium before any white man ever came on this continent. What would be his message to humanity? And the boys, they made all these joking remarks. And then this girl, she was 14 years old. She started to cry, seriously cry. And she was choked up, and two of her friends like put their arms around her and to help her and said, you know, speak, speak. And with a choked voice, she spoke. And it really felt like the tree was speaking through her. Kind of like she was channeling General Sherman Tree. And she, with great emotion, she said, you human beings are so foolish. You have such tiny, insignificant, short little lifetimes. How many generations have gone and passed in 2,100 years? She said, in your human life, you have the opportunity to connect with your eternal soul, to realize your own existence beyond birth and beyond death. Why do you waste your time fighting, having wars, and obsessing your minds with such insignificant, superficial, foolish little attachments and pleasures in your insignificant little lifetime? All your wars, all your fighting, all your time wasted on what? Why not seek the true eternal treasure of the soul? We were all speechless as this 14-year-old girl was speaking. And then we were so, it felt so much like the tree was talking to us through her, that we all gathered in a circle around the tree. It took 40 of us to go around the tree. That's how wide he is. And we all chanted kirtan, Maha Mantra kirtan for the tree for about half hour. Tried to liberate that poor soul. Can you imagine standing without moving for so long? But that's the lesson that the Avadhut in the jungle learned from the moon. That the soul never changes. The body, the mind, everything is changing. Why not focus on what's really important in life? And he told what he learned from fire. Fire is incredible. Fire is so necessary. If it's cold, fire can keep us alive by keeping us warm. Yes? If fire is properly controlled, it can cook wonderful meals for us. If fire is properly controlled, it can give us beautiful light. But if that same fire is out of control, it's totally devastating. I'm from Chicago. And some generations before me, there was the Great Chicago Fire. Have you ever heard of that? Well, the story, the legend, I believe it's true because I have my own ideals, but the legend is that I was taught since I was born practically that there was a lady named Miss O'Leary, and she had a cow. And one night, you know, she was out there with her cow, and she had a little lantern because this is before electricity, and the cow kicked the lantern, and it went in the hay, and it started her barn on fire, and that went to the next barn. It burned down the entire city. One of the greatest fires in history. And even today, there's the water tower of Chicago. It's the only building that stood in the entire city in that fire. Now, it's interesting because some years later, Chicago had the largest slaughterhouse in America. So it seems like this cow was kind of getting revenge a little ahead of time. Or giving a karmic reaction, whatever. But it's the nature of fire, so beautiful. Fire is like the mind. Krishna tells in Gita that when the mind is controlled, it's the best of friends. But when the mind is uncontrolled, it can create a forest fire. It's our worst enemy. So it's very, there's that saying, don't play with fire. Very serious thing. So he explained, I learned about how important it is to control and balance our minds and our lifestyles from fire. And another thing about fire, it's really incredible because it looks like a flame, but actually it's constantly changing. Time is like fire. The flame of a fire, as soon as it exists, it doesn't exist. Yes, it's not that there's just one thing that's burning a house down. At every moment, that thing is disappearing, and because of fuel, another thing and another thing, and it's an evolution. It's a progression. It appears as soon as it disappears, and it disappears as soon as it appears. And that's very much like time. You can't hold on to a second. Even if you take the second hand and hold it. And that's what people kind of do. They try to hold back time. But time's not dependent on that little hand. All we really have and to live with is the present moment. The past is gone, the present doesn't exist, and the future doesn't exist. All we have is this present moment, and the present moment disappears as soon as it appears. To be in this present moment, to understand how time works, it's inconceivable. It's so subtle. You can't taste it. You can't touch it. You can't see it. You can't smell it. But yet, it's in the process of burning out the sun, making the earth into powder, pulverizing the greatest mountains, drying up the greatest oceans. And yet, it's so subtle. It's time. But he explained from the fire and from this analysis of time, we could learn to connect ourselves with that immortal flow of truth that is within ourselves. That is beyond the influence of time. He said, another of his gurus is the earth. So the nature of Mother Earth is she provides everything for everyone. And she endures so much abuse. And this is kind of the principle of this eco-village that we've tried to create. Because the earth is our mother. From the scriptural perspective of the Vedas, the feminine aspect of the One Supreme Truth, the male aspect of the Absolute Truth is Krishna, the female Radha. And they go by different names, Ram, Sita, Lakshmi, Narayan, Shiva, Parvati. The feminine aspect of that one truth is the compassionate, forgiving, motherly, nourishing aspect of God. The feminine is the supreme lover, Radha. The masculine is the supreme object of love, Krishna. And we approach the beloved through love. And that Radha or Lakshmi or Sita, when she manifests within the material creation, she becomes Bhumi. Bhumi is Mother Earth. This means that Radha, in the role of Bhumi, is actually the presiding conscious force that animates, activates Mother Earth. Just like we are the eternal soul and we have this body, the earth is like her body. And as the Supreme Mother, she is providing everything for everyone. And in this sense, whoever we are, whether we're kings or warriors or farmers, we're all like little infant babies in relation to Mother Earth, because we're totally dependent. If she doesn't give us air, we can't live. If she doesn't give us water, if she doesn't give us food, if she doesn't give us warmth, we are totally dependent on Mother Earth. And when we understand it in a personal way, that she is our mother, providing everything, then we can understand that we're all actually, God is our Supreme Father, Mother Earth is our Supreme Mother, we're all actually brothers and sisters. And when we recognize that we're all meant to serve the purpose of our mother and father, then there's nothing to fight about. There's nothing to quarrel about. There's no egoism. There's no sectarianism. There's no prejudice. But when we exploit the earth, not only is it ecologically extremely dangerous, but it's spiritually extremely hypocritical and detrimental. If we are grateful for all we receive, then we will offer respect. And there is a law of ecological economics. The law is, whatever you take from Mother Nature, you give back. You give back what will nurture and nourish her to give more. But in today's world, losing connection with that concept, we're taking precious gifts and we're giving back terrible, poisonous waste. And this eco-village, we are trying in our own small ways to give an example to the world, and also to live honestly in our own lives, in a spirit of trying to genuinely reciprocate in a loving way with our Mother Earth. By replenishing her in every way possible, and not unnecessarily exploiting and abusing. All of these bricks we'll see tomorrow are made from the dirt of our own land. And they're not fired. They're just pressed by hand. Maybe we'll set up the machine and you could all make your own brick. But you have to really pull hard to compress it, because it's really compressed. And then you just dry it in the sun for a day and then put it up, and it could last hundreds and hundreds of years. And water, such a precious gift. But our tendency is we just waste things. We don't see their value. But water storage is very, very crucial. There's drought in India for most of the year. And when the monsoons come, it's massive storms. So why not catch all that water and save it? So we made on the roofs, so almost every drop of water that lands on the roofs of these buildings, it goes in the little chains. It goes out of a hole in the different corners of the roofs, and then there's little chains that hold, and those It's incredible. The chains keep all the water. There's a few little chains. Have you seen them? And all the water goes into a tank underground. And that water that was just on the roof, that ordinarily would have just been gone, supplies for that building practically for 6 months. All the water required. Organic farming actually, instead of depleting the topsoil, nourishes the topsoil. So these are some ideas that we feel it's not just ecologically friendly, but it's divine. It's a sacred way of living when we actually are recognizing how we are offering our honor, our worship, our love to Mother Earth. To God, to Krishna, to Radha. And just like our body, if you don't give, when our body is nourished with water and sunshine and everything, it's healthy. But if it's bombarded with overdoses of toxins, it gets sick. That's what we've done to our mother. But she still keeps giving and giving and giving. And he said he learned this from the Mother Earth, how no matter what, she's always eager to serve everyone without discrimination. And he said he learned another lesson from his guru, the wind. Are you still awake? He said from the wind he learned detachment. He said when the wind goes through a flower garden, it carries a very sweet aromatic fragrance. And then that same wind passes through a sewage area and it carries an abominable stench. So is the wind aromatic or is the wind disgusting? Actually, the wind is neutral. But it's very much, it just carries according to the atmosphere around it. And he said, similarly, a great personality who actually is experiencing this higher taste of yoga, higher taste of bhakti, higher taste of love, may go through all situations, sometimes painful situations, sometimes pleasurable situations, sometimes through great challenges, and sometimes in very comfortable environment. But because we're experiencing that inner joy, apuryamana majala pratishtam, we're not affected by these things. And that is one of the great blessings that one can receive through yoga, is finding that peace of mind which is so deep and so full and so rich and so real within ourselves that even though we live and deal with all these various situations of the world, happiness, distress, honor, dishonor, pleasure, pain, success, failure, victory, defeat, health, disease. There are limitless dualities in this world. And whoever we are, we don't always have much control over. Should I tell you a little story on this subject? The person whose house we were at last night? Don't tell him I told you this story. Anyways, he's a billionaire. He's one of the 100th wealthiest men on planet Earth. He owns all these big mines. So, last year, or maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago it was, I was just trying to mind my own business and do my service in Mumbai. And then I got a call from one of my dearest friends. He told me that his wife was dying of cancer and she only had 10 days to live. And then she was going to die. And he said, because I've known her for so many years, she was like a sister to me, she was like a mother to me, she was like a friend to me. And she said she really wanted to see me before she died. So, you know, the husband called and said, could you please come to London? That's where she lived. So I went and got a plane ticket to go to London. And then this volcano erupted in Iceland. Do you remember that? And the ashes from the volcano filled the entire continent of Europe. And they canceled every single flight and closed every airport in the entire Europe, Eastern Europe, and North Africa. And I was thinking, this is really instructive. Of all places, Iceland. You know, they don't have a big military. They don't have a big population. This little insignificant island somewhere, Iceland, is completely disrupting the whole planet. Because if Europe is shut down, that means, you know, people can't, it's disrupting the planet. So there was no way I could get there. Now, the way I got to London the first time I went, I hitchhiked. But that took 6 months. And she only had 10 days. So every day I was hoping, you know, I was changing my flight to the next day, and I was hoping that, you know, the volcano would become nice. So finally, you know, they were calling me and saying she only has one more day to live. And I waited till the night, because they would never cancel the flight until just before it was supposed to, you know, board. So I was in my little room, you were all there. I have a little straw mat that I sleep on. And after I got malaria some years ago, I put a little mosquito net up sometimes. So it was about 9 o'clock at night. And usually I'm out late doing lectures and everything. But everything was put aside to go to London. So I was just crawling under my mosquito net to go to sleep early. I was really sad I couldn't see my god sister, Amekala. But I was thinking, at least I get to sleep early for once. So I was just crawling, and right when I was about to lay down, Anil just walks in my room. Now, you can all picture him, right? He said, what are you doing tonight? I said, I'm going to sleep. He said, why don't you come with me? I said, oh, where are you going? He said, to Zambia. I left school in 1969. And the African countries, you know, they all changed their names since then. I said, where's Zambia? He said, you know Zambia? It's right, it borders Congo in Africa. He said, come with me. He said, I have a private jet, and I'm flying there, and I'm all alone, and I really would love your company. You know, you could preach to me and tell me about Krishna and everything, and we'll go to Zambia. And he said, I'll get nice prasad, we'll have a great time, let's go, please come. He said, it'll just be the two of us. So, then he said, but I heard you wanted to go to see your sister in London. He said, from Zambia, somehow or other, I'll get you to London in my private jet. So, I wanted to ask Radharani about this. Because this was quite inconceivable. But my experience in life is everything is more or less inconceivable. So I got up and I went to the temple room, and they were just about to close the doors to put Radha Gopinath to sleep. And they were just in their last darshan. And I went in the temple and I stood before Radha and Gopinath. And I said a little prayer to Radharani, silently. I didn't say a word with my lips. I just, in my heart, I said, Radharani, do you want me to go to Zambia? And right when I said that, the pujari took the garland off her hand and came up and put it around my neck. And then I actually spoke. I said, all right, Radharani, I'll go to Zambia. So about an hour later, I'm flying on this private jet with Anil over the Arabian Sea. We were going to Dubai to get refueled and then down to Zambia. Really, quite a detour from London. So as we're flying over the Arabian Sea, Anil says to me, I hope you have a visa for Zambia. I said, I don't even know where Zambia is. I didn't even know it existed until an hour ago. I don't have a visa. And I said, but this private jet is so nice. You know, you go and do whatever you want in Zambia. I'll just stay here. And he said, but the president is attending my function, so he'll probably let you in. So we landed in Zambia. He has his own airport there, and he's copper mines. And he's the largest employer in the whole country. I think he has like 60,000 employees for this copper mine. And they were inaugurating something. And all these ambassadors from different nations, and there was about 500 people in the audience from all over the world. They were quite, you know, materially accomplished people. And Anil's on the stage with the president. And then they're driving away. And the president, he's a very gigantic person, physically, African man. And he says to Anil, because they put me in the front row, do you like this story?
Yeah.
Okay. The president of Zambia says to Anil, did you see that person with the orange robes in the front row? And Anil said, yes. He said, do you know who he is? And Anil said, yes, I came with him from India. And the president said, well, who is he? And Anil wanted to impress him. He said, he is a mystic Indian soothsayer. So the president said, he's a soothsayer from India? And Anil said, yes, I came with him. He said, I came with him for good luck. And the president said, do you think he'll meet, do you think I could meet him? And Anil said, I'll ask him. You know, for those of you who may have read The Journey Home, I've done a lot of hitchhiking in my life, but this was a very high level of hitchhiking. Like 40,000 feet above sea level, I was hitchhiking. So there was this function with all these people, a banquet after this event, and I met the president, and he asked me for a copy of Journey Home, so I happened to have one. He was very, very gracious, nice man. And then the event was over. And he has a really nice guest house near his mines. But he said, I want to take you to the capital, where I have a penthouse suite for you and for me, where we'll stay tonight. I said, this guest house is much better than I deserve or need. You know, we don't have to go to the capital to get a penthouse suite. He said, no, it's much better, it's much better. I'm more comfortable there, he said. So he said, well, we're gonna go to the capital and we're gonna spend the night there, and then the next day we'll go to London. But we had to get fuel before we went to the capital, and his airport doesn't have fuel, so we went to this really, really run down old town that was like whatever industry was there totally collapsed, so there was no money there and there was hardly anything there. But we went there to get refueling, and as we landed, massive rainstorm. It was tumultuous. And it wasn't the rainy season. And the pilot said, this is completely impossible. It's totally unseasonable. It never rains like this at this time of the year. He said, we can't fly in this rain. It's too much. It was really a deluge of rain, and what's going on? And we were sitting in the plane in the middle of nowhere, just for hours and hours. And he said, we can't stay in the plane for whatever law or something. We have to go out. And he said, we can't fly tonight. It's too much rain. So you have to go somewhere. So we get out, and it's a massive storm, and we're with all these little umbrellas. They put us in a little car, and they bring us to this kind of shack to sleep. It's this really old, run-down, deserted guest house. And I said, I'm fine. And I remember when I was laying there, I was laughing, and Anil said, why are you laughing? I said, why not? There's nothing we could do. You know, even if you're the billionaire, and even if you have private jet, and even if you know the president of the nation, there's just the world, the nature of the world is there is things out of your control that could just reverse all our plans. But it was incredible because he was just completely happy. We just did kirtan together. We were in this little shack doing kirtan and he was dancing and smiling. And he was telling me, he said, you know, it's really the only way you could be happy is with kirtan and all this. It's all this stuff is out of your control ultimately. So the next day, a pilot said we couldn't leave till noon. So he said, well, is there anything you want to do till noon? I said, well, it's the first time I've ever been in Africa in my life. Is there any elephants or lions or anything that we can go see? And he asked somebody and they said, no, you have to drive 8 hours to see them or something like that. So he said, let's just take a ride. So we took a ride into some villages, and the amazing thing, these villages looked absolutely identical to the villages in this area of Maharashtra where our farm is. Did you see the little villages on the way here? The construction, the building materials were identical. And there was a well, and there was all these ladies around the well pulling it up, and they had clay pots, and they were putting it on their heads. It was just like India. You know, the complexion was a little darker. That was the only difference. And I was, well, it's okay, I guess. That's what I'm supposed to see. And then finally, we took off and refueled in Tunisia, and somehow or other, even though the airports were closed, we went to some private little airport somewhere. Not a private airport, a different airport than the big one. And we flew into London. And when we arrived, it's a whole different way of flying. The immigration comes up to your plane, takes your passport and fills out the forms. And gives you some gift. And you don't have to go to the airport. They come up to the plane, and then your car is right. He had a beautiful Bentley waiting for him, and I had this beat up old van that someone came to pick me up with. So he said, why don't you ride in my car? I said, no, I have to go see my friend. So we arrived at midnight, and the next morning, around 6 a.m, I went, and she was still alive. And I spent, you know, the whole morning with her, then I gave her some time in the afternoon, then I spent the whole evening with her. And she passed away. It was literally just in time. And I was telling about, she's the one I was talking about. I told the story the other day, where she said, she was her last stage of cancer. She couldn't move. When she responded to nature's call, someone had to clean her, someone had to spoon feed her. She said, I am supremely relevant, significant, and I have supreme value because Krishna loves me. And because Krishna loves everyone, everyone has infinite value and relevance. And no one can take that away from anyone. And while she was laying on her deathbed speaking these things, it was such a lesson that if Krishna loves everyone, why shouldn't we? And if Krishna loves everyone, that gives, that whatever our situation may be, whoever we are, we have unlimited value. And we should see that in ourselves. And because we have unlimited value, we shouldn't think I'm better than someone else, because they have the same value. I have infinite value, and you have infinite value, and every living being has infinite value. And what a wonderful consciousness that is. Because she was actually being touched and experiencing Krishna's love. It was beautiful. So after King Yadu learned all these wonderful lessons from this avaduta laying in the jungle, and he realized that God is speaking through even the simplest, most everyday experiences of life, if only we open our hearts and ears to receive it. One of his gurus was the sun, the wind, the moon, the earth. And every one of these lessons was fully competent to give him total enlightenment. How often do we see the sun? How often do we see the moon? Or feel the wind? Or see fire? How often do we see the earth? Or a mountain? These are all different of his gurus. One of his gurus was a pigeon. In the Bible it is said, seek and ye shall find. Knock and the door opens. If we're actually seeking, if we're actually trying to hear God's voice, we can gain such enrichment in every situation in life. But if we're not looking, it's right there. The moon is speaking to us at every moment, but we don't hear, we don't see the sun. My beloved Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, he used to say that we talk about nature. But when we speak nature, the natural question is, whose nature? This whole nature is Radha's nature, Krishna's nature. And when we understand that, then we can actually be receptive. And when we have satsang, association with people really who are tuned in to this divine message, tuned in to this bhakti, to this love, Krishna's love that's speaking in every situation, everywhere, then we also could learn how the one supreme guru can speak through so many other gurus. To awaken that prema, that love from our hearts. To rise us above all the egoism and selfishness that divides us in so many ways. Useless ways. This kirtan, or chanting of the holy names, is meant to actually tune us in. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Arrivo.